Good afternoon. On behalf of the Roush Pack, I'd like to welcome all of you to today's webcast. As I think many of you gathered here and many of you who are listening via the internet are aware, it is ironically the exact anniversary of a similar presentation that Mr. LaRouche gave here in Washington, in which he declared without any reservation that the collapse was not about to occur, but that, in fact, it was ongoing. When Mr. LaRouche said that, people felt that it was a radical statement, that it was perhaps hyperbole, that perhaps it was a metaphor that was declared for effect. Yet, here we are, a year later. None of the solutions that Mr. LaRouche put on the table 1 year ago were adopted. And look at where we are right now. Over the course of the last week, we've seen the failure of one major bank. Today, every American woke up to the nervous jitters of losses posted by Wachovia, which I believe now is this nation's largest bank. And in the words of many of our nation's top economists, what we are in the throes of right now is the beginning of the end. At the same time, we're in a presidential campaign where the two apparent nominees don't really have very much to say about the economy. John McCain, the Republican, says that economics was never really his strong point. And in the case of Barack Obama, his actions since early June are inexplicable even to those who are closest to him. And in fact, many are referring to him these days as the Manchurian candidate, despite the fact that he seems to have virtually every ethnic ingredient in his background but Chinese. Although, who knows? However, it is with this backdrop that Mr. LaRouche once again comes to this podium. Once again, with clear proposals to avoid complete social chaos, and perhaps now with ruling circles in the United States and in Europe with far greater appetites for those solutions than they had a year ago. There are more things that I could say. And there are more things that will be said during the course of today's proceedings. But I know that I'm very anxious to hear what Mr. LaRouche has to say. I believe that you are as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you. Thank you. The first thing to settle is that the present international monetary financial system will die and will never recover. This system is finished. The only possibility that exists now is to create a replacement system based on the principles of the founding of the U.S. economic system with the founding of the actual constitutional government, as defined under particularly Alexander Hamilton. If you don't understand and agree with Alexander Hamilton, it's like saying there is no future for you. Now, last year, I proposed in steps three specific remedies, which are not cures of the problem, but are absolutely necessary to be put into place immediately, then, and even more so now. these three remedies. Without that, there's no future for the United States and no future for the world. We're not looking at a depression. We're looking at what is called a general breakdown crisis. That is where money goes out of existence. It's no longer really negotiable. So-called financial assets don't exist. Everything evaporates. In a worse crisis than the type that occurred during the middle of the 14th century Europe, which was called a New Dark Age, a period which half the parishes of Europe disappeared and one-third of the total population. It was not until a half century later, with the Renaissance, that there was the beginning of a recovery of civilization, and that was almost a miracle. What we face today is a crisis which is very similar, under admittedly different historical circumstances, than that of Europe's 14th century. It's much worse, but of the same type. And without a miraculous solution, a dramatic solution, not reforms, but a dramatic, complete solution, a new system, without putting a new system of the proper design into effect immediately, not by experimenting back and forth, but by putting the system in with foreknowledge and according to prescription. Without that, those measures, there is no possibility that civilization will survive as civilization. Mankind would survive after a vast depopulation of the planet, probably as much as the 2.5 billion people that Al Gore and Prince Philip of England want. Remember that Al Gore is a stooge for Prince Philip. Al Gore is like Aaron Burr. Both were once vice presidents of the United States. Both were traitors to the United States on behalf of the British monarchy. And the prince has demanded that the human population drop from 6.5 billion presently to less than 2 billion, and that in short order. Al Gore's entire career is devoted to that end, and he is a flunky of Prince Philip. He is a British agent like Aaron Burr, the traitor. He is implicitly a traitor, and he is trying to run for President of the United States as soon as Obama drops. That's his big ambition, or his two ambition. Yeah? Now, what I proposed, to review what I proposed a year ago in SEPs. First of all, that all regular banks be put into protection, bankruptcy protection, by the federal government. This means they will not close their doors. This means that there will be a restriction on which of their accounts will be paid. The rest will be frozen. At the same time, there will be no evictions of householders because of mortgage default. They will remain in their homes under conditions which are acceptable conditions, and they will continue to function under bankruptcy protection. There will be no foreclosures. There must be no foreclosures, except in the ordinary case where there should be anyway because people are leaving or so forth. But where people intend to stay in their homes, there should be no foreclosures. You can have foreclosures on things which are, in a sense, held out for rent, but not for occupancy. That's number one. The idea is the first thing you have to do is you have to save the people. And the people, in general, live in homes. Many of them are, well, some live elsewhere, you know. Some of our youth live in strange places. And there are new types of places are being invented at all times. We are not going to have communities shut down, which means that the local bank on which the community depends for its functioning will not be closed. The doors will remain open. This, however, is only for certain banks. for banks which are banks of deposit and chartered under the federal government and the state governments as depository institutions which engage in bank and lending. So therefore, the first thing was bank, house homeowners, householders, and Bankers Protection Act. That was necessary. It was presented actively around the country. It was blocked. It was blocked by the Democratic Party leadership. Blocked by the same people who presumably were enthusiastic until recent time for Barack Obama. So we see the result. We see the foreclosures are now moving in. Communities are being shut down. And the banks are closing, like Wachovia and others. Wachovia is a piece of junk, but it also does regular banking. And it gobbled up a lot of small banks. And therefore, we have a threat to the continued functioning of communities in which people live. That is, even if we keep them in their homes, the jobs on which they depend to stay in their homes are going away because the banks which are involved with these jobs are being closed. The rate of bank foreclosures across the Atlantic and around the world is beyond imagination. That's the first measure. It wasn't done. A year has passed since I proposed that. It has not been done. Even though towns and even city organizations, towns, cities, and state organizations have proposed that it be done, it has not been done. The Congress of the United States, under the leadership of Nancy Pelosi, has blocked this absolutely. And she's on the wrong side. She should get on another side, outside. Nothing has been done to protect the banks. What's happened? Let's take the case, just a recent case in this vicinity. Bank of America. Countryside. Bank of America was told to absorb a dead corpse inside its body. Countryside. Countrywide. We have been destroying banks that should have been saved by putting the bomb inside them in order to support institutions which are not worth saving and should have been allowed to die because they're of no use to the community. We don't need those mortgages. Those mortgages are a problem. We don't need these things. That wasn't done. So I had two other proposals which I put out forth during the course of those months. First of the two, we must have a two-tier credit system. Now, I don't know if Hank Paulson has the knowledge or guts to take this up. I'm not sure he has the knowledge involved. He probably will have an inclination or a wish to do something in that direction. But so far, he's done nothing. He's a half-competent person, but not fully competent. He's the Treasury of the Secretary. He's the Secretary of the Treasury. And I don't think he or almost anyone else in authority in Washington has the guts to do what I've proposed, create a two-tier credit system. In other words, the proposal is 4% is the standard interest rate for regular banking, the basic interest rate. Now, the purpose of that is not just adjusting the interest rate. We have a situation now where our enemy, as it was in the time of Aaron Burr, is merry old England. And merry old England set up a system in Europe under which England has the, Great Britain has the highest official interest rate. Europe has a slightly lower interest rate. And the United States has been driven down to 2% and is threatened lower, which is insane. This manipulation has the following effect. The British are determined to destroy the United States. That's what that is about. And they say so. And many in Europe are out to destroy the United States. They say, good, this is going to destroy the United States. And that's what the 2% interest rate is, borrowing rate is, destroy the United States. Because what happens then with a 2% interest rate, a discount rate, what you get is an outflow of the capital, of the financial capital, from the U.S. banking system. I am determined that I can beat the British and sink them and kick Europeans who cooperate with the British in the head by a 4% standard rate throughout the Federal Reserve System. Why? Because the British are a bunch of parasites. They don't use the money for solid investment. The continental Europeans are not allowed to do that under the Maastricht agreements. Therefore, if you protect bank deposits by having a 4% interest rate in the United States, that means that you're going to keep your financial capitalists viable in those banks. That is, you're not going to take the capital out of the banks and put it on the street for lending and take it out of the bank. You're going to keep it in the bank, but you're going to use the bank credit of that capital, financial capital, in the bank as a lendable asset, which you will lend either at 4% or with government protection, federal government protection, as low as 1% to 2% for special projects. That means the capital of the United States, including its financial assets, its credit, will not be depleted the way it's being sucked dry now. We don't have to have a 5% interest rate, the type the British are using. We don't need that, because the British are a bunch of parasites. They don't invest in their own country. We invest in our country. We have to invest in our country. Therefore, if we have credit in the bank, we're not going to take the money out of the bank. What we're going to do, the federal government will simply take the fact that the Federal Reserve System banks and its affiliates have credit in the form of deposits or equivalent of deposits in the bank. They will now issue loans, which will be new money in a sense in circulation, for specific purposes on the basis of the asset, the financial asset, which remains in the bank. In other words, the first thing here is to keep the financial assets of the United States, regular banking system, as much as possible inside the United States. Don't deplete that capital by shipping it out and loaning it. Keep it in the banks as credit under federal regulation with the assistance of the Federal Reserve Board. Then use that credit in the banks to utter new credit for authorized purposes to make the economy grow and to solve some of the problems. That's a defensive measure. It's not a solution. It's a defensive measure. We had a similar kind of situation in the past. Roosevelt did that in his own different way, under different circumstances. We need to have a growth program. Now, a physical growth program, not a financial growth program as such, but a physical growth program. We have people losing jobs. We have communities disintegrating. We have infrastructure going. We have health care collapsing. We need tangible investments, job-creating investments, physical capital investments, infrastructure investments. We need them. We've got to increase our rate of employment, of productive employment especially. We don't need more bookkeepers. Look what they've done to us. What we need is work. We need significant production. So we're simply at the first stage. We have to say on a Tuesday, for example, that now the banking system is now under protection. And the Federal Reserve System is bankrupt. So what? The Federal Reserve System is not the U.S. government. The Federal Reserve System is a chartered banking system. It will be put into bank receivership for protection by the federal government. Then it will function as like a regular banking system under the U.S. Treasury. The credit it uses will be the debt of the U.S. government under the U.S. credit system. And that credit that generated will then be used through the banking system, and when not directly by the government, to create the additional investments we need to stabilize this economy. Now, what that means in respect to Europe. Europe today, Western and Central Europe, under Maastricht, is not allowed to do anything intelligent. It's a British trick. So therefore, Europe is not able to do this as long as it remains under the Maastricht dictatorship. We are free if we can get rid of that idiot in the White House or get him under control. We are free to begin a defensive measure to defend the U.S. banking system, to build up the relative value of the dollar relative to every other currency on this planet. And our friends in China will be happy with that, because right now they're about to lose everything because of the collapse of the dollar. We are going to defend the value of the U.S. dollar. We are going to increase its value on the markets by doing this, by these kinds of measures, if we can get our idiots under control. We have to do it, because if we don't do it, we will die. And the problem is you've got people who say, well, I would like to do that, but, you know, I'm so risky, it's so awesome, I don't think we could do that. Buddy, you're not telling people what you got to tell them. Look, buddy, the word is, the ship is sinking. Get off it. Don't negotiate for a new stateroom on the Titanic. This thing is going down. Do you want to go down with it? Well, if you don't want to go down with it, get into this lifeboat. Now, don't tell me it's too fearful to get into the lifeboat. What you ought to be afraid of is the sinking ship, not the lifeboat. And what I'm proposing in this respect is simply setting up a system, a flotilla of lifeboats to save the U.S. dollar. And I think we could increase that by about 20 or 30% fairly rapidly, which I think some of our friends in China will be a little bit relieved by that, because we owe them a lot in dollars. And if these dollars are collapsing, that is not good. We have to defend the U.S. dollar. As necessary for us, it's necessary for the world. And there's no, it's too scary. No, it's not too scary. Going down in the Titanic is scary. The lifeboat is a little bit worrying, but it's a better option. And any intelligent person would recognize that. Right. The third thing is, this can't go on indefinitely. We must take measures of defense to defend the U.S. dollar. We must have a goal of increasing the relative value of the U.S. dollar by 20% in the short term. I think we can do it if we can get the right action from Washington. Right. But now we've got to go to a further step. We then have to go, and this is going to be the tricky one. This is where you send Obama to the woodshed or someplace else. We have to have a presidential candidate of the United States, because we can't wait till November. Sometime in the short time ahead, we have to have a leading presidential candidate of the United States affirm what I have proposed be done. That is, the United States must propose to the governments of Russia, China, and India that these four major countries will agree to sponsor a committee, an alliance of powers, including other powers, to establish a fixed exchange rate financial or credit system internationally of the type that Roosevelt intended in 1944, not what Truman did in 1945. What Roosevelt proposed was a credit system whose intention was to eliminate colonialism, especially British colonialism. And Roosevelt said that repeatedly, very clearly to Churchill. Winston, when this war is ended, Winston, we're not going to have your empire. We're not going to have colonies. These people are going to be free. They're going to have their own governments and no more empire. And are we going to do that? Well, we had the greatest military machine the world had ever known, a production machine. Where the Nazis would produce in a few hundred pounds, we would produce in tons. Our soldiers were not well trained in general. They've just got into the service off the streets or out of the woods. It's a short time earlier. Trained in 16 weeks and a few other weeks and sent overseas to war. This is not really recommended army. But we had tonnage. Every man in service had tonnage behind him. And with that tonnage and that power of mobility, logistics that we had, we won the war. Together with other people who cooperated with us, with our aid of our tonnage. It was our tonnage that Russia depended upon, the Soviet Union depended upon, to defend itself against Hitler. It was tonnage that was required. Tonnage of material. So we had the greatest machine for production the world had ever known. At the end of the war, it had been built up in large degree for military purposes. But there's no difference between logistics for a military purpose and the technology required to build for an economy. Bridges, ships, railway systems, everything, machine tools. All of these kinds of things are just as much interchangeable with material for war and material for peace. Roosevelt's intention, as he stated clearly, was that once the war is ended, Winston, and this was in the Casablanca, we are not going to have your system anymore. And he laid out a scheme for a large-scale development of Africa. We're not going to have colonies anymore. We're going to help these people have independent nations. We're going to cooperate with them. And we're going to eliminate your empire, Winston. Well, the problem was is that Roosevelt died. And Truman was a stooge for the British. That's no exaggeration. So what Churchill did was enter into alliance with Truman and with the British behind Churchill, and they decided they're going to start a preventive nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. Why? To defeat Roosevelt's intention. Because Roosevelt's intention was to take China, Russia, and the United States, who were the leading powers of the world at that moment, at the end of the war, and through a system of cooperation, redevelop the world, a war-torn, ruined world. So what did you do? You start a war with the leading allies and partners of the United States under Roosevelt. You start a war with Truman against those same allies in order to preserve what? The British Empire. Instead of eliminating British colonies, Churchill and company, with Truman's support, backed the reinstallation. For example, under British orders, the Japanese troops were in prison camps in Indochina, were told to get out of the prison camps, pick up their weapons, and go back into the occupation of Indochina. Indochina had freed itself from French imperialism with U.S. backing. Ho Chi Minh was a friend of the United States, a friend of Roosevelt, a friend of Roosevelt's machine. We turned friends into enemies, allies into enemies. We helped the Dutch do the same thing in the Indies. We made a mess of the freedom of India a year after I left the place. Again, the British. So we, under Truman, we systematically destroyed Roosevelt's intention. Roosevelt's intention was we take our great economic machine, our agro-industrial machine for capital goods, and we use this weapon to free the subjugated people, and by doing so, to free the world from the damn British Empire. And Truman was an ally of the cause of the British Empire. And that's how this mess came about. That's how we came to a Cold War through this process. How we came to witch hunt terror in the United States. How our youth, born between, to a large degree, the white collar youth, born between 1945 and 1958, were in large degree turned into a passive pack of intellectual mongrels, degenerates, by things like the Congress for Cultural Freedom and the comparable existentialist operations inside the United States. This is where the 68ers came from, a product of the same thing that happened in France under Napoleon III, which became known as the Sinarchists. And what we have today among a certain strata of the white collar baby boomers, now generally between 50 and 65 years of age, they are Sinarchists. They are fascists. And that's what Bohr's constituency is, fascist. That's what the environmentalist movement is. It's fascist. It's a Sinarchist movement modeled upon the Sinarchism as developed under Napoleon III, which was then put through various existentialist migrations in the 20th century where it became known as fascism, including the fascism of H.G. Wells of Britain, that sort of thing. So that's been the problem. So what we have to do is recognize that where Roosevelt was going to use the productive power of the United States at the end of the war, we were the greatest power the planet had ever known in terms of financial, economic power, to use that power to free the world from imperialism by helping nations, which should be nations, to become nations, and creating a fraternity of nations based on this idea of building a world system of sovereign nation states, which would eliminate empires, especially the British Empire. And all the hell that we've had, and we've had a lot of it up to the present time, since the day Franklin Roosevelt died, has all been a result of this damn British Empire. Our job as the United States is to reaffirm the commitment of Franklin Roosevelt before he died, a commitment he stated clearly to many people, leading people of the world at that time, while he was still alive, to free and help the development of people who have been semi-captive or captive people to the world, and to build an alliance of sovereign nation states to manage this world and to end empire forever, and to devote ourselves to the missions of the Peace of Westphalia. The mission of man is not to win wars. Sometimes we have to fight war, but that's not our intention. The power and importance of a nation does not lie in fighting wars. Wars are terrible things. They're awful things. Some baby boomers don't understand that. That's why they sent people into this thing in Iraq, because they don't understand what war is. War is something which you do, if necessary, as briefly as possible, and do everything possible to avoid it, if you understand war. So the aim of sovereignty is not to become a war power. The need to be able to defend one's nation, yes. But to become a war power, no. To become an empire, no. We are peoples on this planet of different cultural backgrounds. We depend upon our association with culture, our culture, in order to think, in order to communicate among ourselves, among our own people. And to unite our people with a common culture, or what becomes a common culture, to cooperate with nations of other cultures, and to define common aims of mankind, common goals of mankind. I'll refer to one here today of that type. This is something we're supposed to have learned in 1648 with the Peace of Westphalia. The aim of the victory lies not in war, but in peace, in the peace of peoples who have replace killing each other with cooperating with each other, and using their differences in cultural background as a basis for their cooperation, not for their conflict. And to use the weapons of warfare only as is necessary to maintain and defend that peaceful order, with a minimum of effort, a minimum of conflict when necessary. So, therefore, the time has come, instead of saying, who is the enemy? I can tell you who the enemy is. A British Union jerk. That's an enemy. There are other enemies. But how do we overpower our enemies? What's the best way to overpower our enemies? To conquer them? No. Conquest is not victory. It's to dissuade them from continuing to be enemies. And how was that done in 1648? It was done through the Peace of Westphalia, of putting the benefit of the other above one's own. And if people do that, then you have a system of cooperation, a Westphalian system, as it's called. That's Roosevelt's intention, was to create a global Westphalian system, to take leading nations of the world, which at that time were the United States, China, and Russia, the Soviet Union then, who had conflicts, very serious conflicts, yeah? And to take these nations and bring them together by working each for the benefit of the others, the common benefits. Now, today we are at a point where there's one project which typifies what should be done. It's a project that came out of the success of the United States in defeating the British agents called the Confederacy, the traitors, the Confederacy. We had developed in the United States, as nowhere else, we had developed the concept of transcontinental railway systems. Transcontinental railway systems were developed as a technological capability superior to inland water systems. In other words, what Charlemagne did in Europe, Charlemagne took the rivers of Europe under his regime, identified the rivers of Europe, and prescribed a program of developing canal systems which would connect these rivers in such a way that you would have an inland water-based transportation system for freight in particular throughout Europe. As a matter of fact, that system was just completed recently at the beginning of the 1990s, the last leg, the Rhine-Danube connection. So railroads came along, and usually we'll find the first major railroads ran along the side of rivers and canals, like the Baltimore and Ohio system. You will find the old system, the railway system, ran beside the canal, the Baltimore and Ohio Canal, which was a very important strategic development in the United States. Today, we have the same challenge in a different form. What the war has been, in the wars, all the important wars of the world fought since 1876 have been so-called geopolitical wars. Geopolitical wars meant that the United States had built a model as a continental power, a transcontinental power, from the Atlantic to the Pacific and from the Canadian to the Mexican border. This nation had been developed as an integral nation largely by aid of augmenting existing and potential waterborne systems by railway systems, integrated the territory. By 1876, every nation of Asia, leading nation of Asia, had, for example, Sun Yat-sen, a little later, a complete railway system for China, a complete design for a railway system. The development of the total internal territory of a nation or a group of nations to enable it to more efficiently than by ocean freight to move people, move goods, move raw materials, develop the territory. So now the fact is that the United States had led in this model. You had in France, you had in Germany, you had in Russia, you had a development in part in China, a conception of taking all of Eurasia, as well as the Americas. The plan for moving railway systems down to the Patagonia from the Canadian border was a policy of that period. And to create a system whose aim was a fraternity of sovereign nation states which would share the benefit of combined inland waterways and railway systems. Today we have the same thing. Today, still then, we had it then, still today. One of the great missions is to develop a maglev system combined with railway system, which by opening up the Bering Strait and by doing similar things into Africa, is to take the major continents of the world and bring them together with one high-speed transportation system for freight and people, especially freight, at maglev speeds, magnetic levitation, 300 miles an hour. These can be modular. You don't have to have all this reloading as we do now. And this means that the raw materials of the world can be developed as they otherwise cannot be developed and managed. So therefore, this is the common interest of mankind to develop this kind of system. We come into a time where we can no longer rely upon burning things as a source of power. We will burn water with nuclear power. What we will do with high-temperature gas-cooled reactors and similar kinds of nuclear power, we will extract hydrogen from water. We will use that fuel based on hydrogen-based fuels, as a substitute replacement for petroleum as a source of power. When that combustion occurs for that fuel, the waste is chiefly water, not a pollutant. We will eliminate the kinds of crude methods we now use by these superior methods. So this is one example, the development of a global power network as a cooperative effort among nations and among continents for the common aims of mankind, a system based on separate sovereign nation states cooperating with aid of these kinds of connections. That we must have that kind of mission, which is a 50-year, 100-year mission for mankind. And when we bring nations together, such as the United States, Russia, China, and India, and other countries today, for a future for mankind, this is what we must have in mind. We must take the needs of various nations, look at what these needs are for 3, 4, 5 generations to come, and say, what projects do we have to develop for the coming 3 to 4 or 5 generations? What are the means we require? What is the apparatus we require to do this job? What are the common aims of mankind? And that's the mentality we must have approach. Now, what we would have is a world system, world credit system, not a money system. You would have money, but you wouldn't have a money system. You have money as a sovereign agency of government, a sovereign instrument of government. But what we would do simply is create a fixed exchange rate system by adjusting exactly, essentially what have been the trends in the relative values of currencies. Fix it there. And say that we're going to keep that fixed exchange rate system. Now, the changes that come after that do not come by manipulating currencies. They come by investment. They come by the use of credit for capital improvements, for large projects, for all these kinds of things, including human development projects. What we do is we're taking what Roosevelt intended in 1944 with a credit system called the Bretton Woods system and uniting countries of the world around a fixed exchange rate system. So money is no longer an instrument of warfare, it's an instrument of cooperation. By a credit system of this type, how we do it is very simple. The United States, under its Constitution, when the Constitution is obeyed, does not have a money system, like a Keynesian monetary system. That's a European disease. It's a very bad disease with some nasty side effects. You get syphilis also, among other things, from that disease. But a credit system, of the United States system, you cannot utter money by central banking systems. Money or credit, which is convertible into money, can be allowed only through actions of governments. That is, no bank can create money. Only a government can create money. And the government creates money by credit, by authorizing the utterance of debt of the government in the form of credit. And it defines that debt as applicable to certain missions, that is, like investments or developments of people. Now, because the United States Constitution is the one major nation in the world which has such a specific conception of economy, if a country such as Russia, China, India, makes a treaty agreement with the United States, which is a credit-based nation, then the currency of those countries, Russia, China, India, and other countries, becomes on an equal status with the United States. It becomes an integral part of a world system while preserving the sovereignty of each of these countries. That's what Roosevelt's intention was. The reason we went to a Keynesian version of the Bretton Woods rather than Roosevelt's intention was the British Empire. Truman decided the United States was going to be a partner of the British Empire in ruling the world. Roosevelt's intention was the opposite, was to create a cooperation among the nations to eliminate the British Empire, which is the old bitch we want to get rid of. I'm not against the England being a sovereign country. That's very good. It's better for them. Look at the way they're treated today. Look at the way they talk. Maybe if they weren't an empire, they would have an English language again. But the point is the simple thing is so simple. A treaty agreement, long-term credit, like 30-year, 50-year agreements on credit among nations which enter into such treaty agreements with the United States automatically have the constitutional advantage of a global credit system rather than a monetary system. And it becomes essentially a fixed exchange rate system. And that's what we need. So, but these things, these measures I've indicated, such as the action on the protection of people against foreclosures on mortgages, protection of real banks as opposed to the phony ones, a two-tier credit system, and an international fixed exchange rate system, these are necessary instruments for creating a new world system which can survive the inevitable death and disintegration of the present world monetary system. This is the only rational, feasible option as alternative to pure hell throughout the planet for generations to come. If you care about humanity, you will insist that these measures be taken boldly and now. Because we are right now, after 1 year of mass stupidity from the top down in the U.S. government and other governments, we're now just weeks away from the point at which the whole system goes into disintegration. What we're looking at is not a 1931. We're looking at something comparable to the 14th century European New Dark Age, which came on suddenly and wiped out half the parishes and one-third of the population of Europe. And that can happen worldwide if we don't stop it. Now, I'm a little bit old to be president of the United States, but I'm not so old that I can't tell one what to do. And that's what I'm saying. I'm saying, you cowardly fools, get up off your butts. Stop this fooling around. Hey, Paulson, get your guts up. I'll show you how to deal with the problem. And there are other people in the banking field and others who will join me in that. They're perfectly good people. They're talented. They don't know as much as they should. They make a lot of mistakes. But look, it's what we got. We got to use what you got. So, but if these fellows will just to have a little bit of my guts and knowledge and act with the intention to do good for this country and for the world at large. And the essential thing is, you're not willing to do good for the world at large, you can't succeed, even in your own country. If you're not willing to enter into an agreement, a long-term agreement on a fixed exchange credit system with Russia, China, India, and with other countries brought into the same group, if you're not willing to do that, sincerely, you're not going to survive. And your descendants, when they come out of the caves, four or five generations from now, will curse your memory unless you do it. This is your opportunity. This is what must be done. Do you have the brains and guts to know you have to do it now? Do you know that Congress must stop what it's doing because what it's doing is no good? And immediately do this. Do we have to get this idiot in the White House somehow to do that, to go along with it, to give Henry Paulson the guts and the advice to do what he's supposed to do as Secretary of the Treasury, to implement this, to get the bankers inside the Federal Reserve System, who are competent bankers, and other bankers outside, together on this, and get a unity among people who understand we're at the end. We're at the end of the system. Stop talking about compromises. Stop talking about halfway measures. We must do this now. We must first agree to do it inside the United States. We must have people inside the United States who will say, we're going to do it. And once we say we're going to do it, we have to have a presidential candidate in the United States who will be credible in saying to the countries of China, Russia, India, and so forth, this is what the United States is committed to do as soon as I get to be president. And we can start it right now. That's how you win wars. And that's what we need right now. Those three measures. We've got people out there, as foolish as they behaved, I know some of them have brains. Some of them have skills. They lack guts. I have the guts. And some of the brains they lack. Let's do it.
Forgot to put my wired jacket back on. So, okay, well, for those of you who have participated in these events before, you know that the way that we proceed with the question and answer period is that we have a number of questions that have been submitted by institutions here in Washington and around the world, but we do also, and we will continue to get questions submitted via the internet. For those of you who are here in the audience who have questions, I will entertain those questions. Either you can ask them yourself from the mic, or I will read the question for you. But what I do need you to do is to indicate your name, the nature of your question, and your affiliation if you have one. And just give it to one of the people on staff who's walking around with index cards so that we can get your question asked. Now, Lynn, we have a number of questions from people here in Washington, and we also have a large number of questions that have come in from elected officials around the country. Many of them are on the topic of the presidential campaign. So why don't we start with a few of them? One is from a former high-ranking, from a former cabinet member, actually, who says, Mr. LaRouche, I do understand that it is your view that when it comes to the election, that nothing is etched in stone. However, it would seem that we do have to prepare for the possibility of an Obama candidacy. So, up to this time, a number of us who have served in past administrations and who have some experience have reached out to the Obama campaign and offered our assistance in shaping policy. So far, all of those efforts have been rebuffed. We are somewhat at a loss as to how to proceed. There is some discussion that what we should do is proceed independently of any candidate and simply step forward and talk about measures that must be taken if the nation is to move safely through this crisis. It seems to me, though, that without a political candidate to rally around, this is a very difficult prospect. We'd very much appreciate your advice.
Okay. I'm not surprised. Well, look, first of all, the idea of people from the Hillary campaign and others approaching people in the Obama campaign or talking to Obama himself is just a sensible thing to do. What you agree to and what you propose have to also be sensible. And your assessment of what the response you're going to get also has to be sensible. You can't have a dream world, a presumption that some miraculous way you're going to get Barack Obama to be reasonable. That he has not been trained to be reasonable. His owners won't let him be reasonable. And he has never done anything reasonable so far in his entire campaign, which means anything for the interests of the people of the United States. He's a babbler. He's a puppet. All right, now, so what's the purpose of, on the one hand, knowing that you will never get anything good out of Obama, don't marry a lizard. You may like the lizard, but you're not going to have children. So don't look forward to that. What you're doing, you're talking about our other citizens who have joined with the Obama campaign, some of them who are very intelligent people, who have been leaders in the Obama campaign, and who are being betrayed by the numbers, as we say, by Obama every time Obama turns around. Even Jesse Jackson, who is not the greatest genius of this planet, has had an instinctive insight into what Obama really is. Now, the point is that Obama is owned chiefly by a guy who got his training under Adolf Eichmann. He was of Jewish origin, but he was used as part of the dirtiest operation in the killing of 500,000 Jews who were assembled in Hungary from areas, not only in Hungary, but Romania and elsewhere. And he was in a conscious part of processing this operation. Now, he was then an adolescent, and even his father was horrified by what he did. And this is all a matter of record. The father has recorded interviews on these questions. Soros has had recorded interviews on these questions. He's never denied any of the facts, essentially. He's denied that it's important to him. He's declared his what he described as his life under Hitler, under Eichmann. He was about, third down from Eichmann in the killer apparatus on his rank. He said it was the happiest time of his life. In other words, he was not somebody who committed something as a young man under great duress. He remained in his personality, in his instinct, in his behavior, exactly what Hitler had made him, what Eichmann had made him. And he's doing it around the world today. To get a picture of this, you take a book by an American, Ben Hecht, who's associated with Hollywood, writer and so forth, wrote a book called Perfidy. And this is what he is. And what Ben Hecht did, the significance of his particular writing on this, on perfidy, is that Jews were processed to do this. And that's what he meant by perfidy. Soros is a Jew who became a Hitler tool, and as a British tool today, and he's still a British citizen, not an American, is doing the same thing today in terms of the way he's acting toward the human race that he did when he was working for Adolf Eichmann back in 1944. In the process of shipping 500,000 Jews gathered from Hungary, Poland, and Romania and so forth, gathering them there for the slaughter. And what Heck referred to, the early part of this, Hitler had gotten a project going under which he offered to release a certain number of Jews for every number of autos supplied by Britain, the United States, and so forth for the German army. And the killing process went on the basis you didn't turn over the Jews, you didn't turn over the trucks, and we killed the Jews. You didn't turn over the trucks, we killed the Jews. And that is the essence of George Soros. It's what he's doing today is not killing Jews in Hungary or in Poland, sending them to Poland to be slaughtered. But he's doing the same kind of thing. He expresses exactly the same mentality. Now, he is the guy who did the most financing. It's not his money. It's British money. And of Howard Scream. Yeah? He's the one, the chief financier, the money up front for creating Obama. Obama, as a politician, is a creation of this. Now, when you're talking about he might be president, wait a minute, buddy. There are some lines you don't cross. He is not fit to be president of the United States, and his being the president of the United States would be the end of the United States. Besides, I don't think he's going to make it anyway, because he's like toilet paper. He's used and disposed of. Huh? Come September, come the end of the primary campaigns, presumably the early September, there's a gentleman sitting in jail in Chicago, Resco. Resco is a British sub-agent. Resco has been convicted on 18 counts, federal counts. That, under present rules, portends a prison sentence of some considerable duration. The federal prosecuting attorney who conducted the case against Resco is planning at the end of, I think, the end of August or beginning of September, to have a little chat again with Mr. Resco. Mr. Resco will find that maybe just a fair turnabout, that for the right conversation from Mr. Resco, a certain part of his sentence might be reduced. So therefore, you're going to have, what the result of that would be probably the impeachment of the governor of Illinois. The whole operation goes back to London, where the operation was conceived in the first place, because the money that came through Resco to Obama, initially personal money for his earlier campaigns, came from London, because Resco had no money. So the house that was bought for Obama came from Britain, from British money, through Resco, who didn't have the money. And Michelle Obama's share of the property also came from the same source. And earlier things of the Obama campaign in Chicago came through the same channel. Obama's a British property. Now look at his performance. What has he done in the campaign? What has he argued for? What are the topics he's raised? What are the issues? He's a puppet. He's a puppet of the enemy of the United States, a puppet of the British Empire, of that faction of the British Empire which is out to destroy us. They don't want him. He's exposed. They don't want another Aaron Burr. They already got one. They got Al Gore. They don't want him. They'll dump him. They'll come up with something which is more nasty. Perhaps the Mussolini of Manhattan, Mayor Bloomberg, who's a tool of the Rockefeller Foundation, who has a program for the United States on infrastructure, which is a direct copy of the model of Benito Mussolini in the 1920s. The Mussolini of Manhattan, Mayor Bloomberg. We have other unsalvageable creatures who also are potential candidates. McCain probably won't make it. Why presume McCain is going to be the presidential candidate? He's being set up. It looks as though we're going to get a Republican candidate of some kind. What flavor? Lemon? Orange? What, sassafras? Whatever. We don't know. But it looks like we're going to get a right-wing president with a fascist program who will not be a Democrat. But a couple of Democrats will be in there for color. And it won't be Obama. Now, all this is subject to change because you're dealing with a bunch of clowns. Just because what I'm saying today may change the British mind on what they're going to do about this thing. They listen very carefully to what I say. Not because they like it, but because they like to suffer. And they've changed their tune a few times. So this does not mean I'm predicting that's what they're going to do. I'm saying this is the situation as it stands today. This is the way the forces are arrayed. Unless they change the array of forces, this is what's going to happen. They may change the array of forces. My saying this today may change their policy. Huh? But Obama was never intended, to be the actual next president of the United States. He was intended to screw things up. And he's done it. And you look at the whole operation. You know, a poor man, gee, this guy, you know, Obama, he defends the poor. He's a change agent. He's not change. He's about $250 million. That's not change. So, we, in dealing with this issue on the question, have to take such considerations I've just outlined into account, such scenarios into account. Because this scenario is simply typical of what a variety of similar scenarios, but with different particular predicates, which are going to come at us. We have to save the United States for the mission I indicated. Therefore, we have to do our work to get a presidential candidacy. In other words, we're not stuck with a person. We're stuck with a candidacy of people who are prepared to go in there, in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, to fight for a policy for the United States and let the policy determine the candidate. Not beg for a candidate and say, well, let's try. Maybe he will give us a good policy. That hasn't worked out too well recently. Let's this time choose the policy and then find the candidates that fit the policy. And we want a candidate who's talking in that direction to begin with, or thinking in that direction. We saw what Hillary did, especially with starting with New Hampshire. She adapted her campaign to a policy impulse. Okay, so we knew what Hillary was. We know what she is today. Huh? We have other figures in U.S. politics. We understand them. Some of them are not electable, but they're decent people. We know what they are. We know what their policy is. If we chose them for something, we would go by their policy and their performance commitment to that policy. We say they're going to stick to that policy, and we like the policy, we think that's the right policy, we should consider them as electable. But we've got to get away from this cheap politics and image politics. We've got to go with we've got to have a candidate for president of the United States. And what does the United States require? What should the United States' mission be? What is the crisis the United States must face in this period ahead? Where can we find a candidate or a group of people around a candidate who will be competent to address that policy question? That's what has always happened in the best periods of the United States. That's what happened with Franklin Roosevelt. Yeah, Franklin Roosevelt was the keystone. But you have to look at the people around him, his team. He didn't do it by himself. He had a team. When you're looking at government, you find, you know, people are so romantic. It's like the other side of tragedy. You know, people who don't understand drama talk about the tragic figure in drama. There is no tragic figure in drama. They're tragic societies. They're tragic cultures. They're not tragic individuals. The individual in the tragic is a victim of his culture. And he acts as an agent of his culture. It's not that he made a mistake. He has the wrong culture. The society has the wrong culture. That's what the problem is. And we go with this idea of the personality cult. Yeah, personalities are important. All great ideas are discovered by individual minds. But what does humanity depend upon? It's what those individual minds do in developing forces in society which organize ways of meeting the requirements of society. We've got to stop thinking in terms of this figure. We have to think in terms of people who are tested and who group around them a team that is going to address a job that has to be done efficiently. And I think the process is occurring in the United States right now around the various aspects that are around Hillary earlier and others, and people in the Obama camp who are not happy with this guy, who are leading people. You have to have an open door on this, and you have to have an open discussion on the question of policy first. Issues and policy first. And fit the candidate around which to rally on the basis of policy.
Lynn, I think in large part you've answered some of the questions that I'm going to ask you, but given the rank of the people asking them, I'm going to ask them anyway. This is from a current member of Congress who says, "Mr. LaRouche, as you know, for a variety of reasons, I've been an Obama backer from the start, although I do have the highest regard for Hillary Clinton. We who backed Obama knew that if he became the Democratic nominee, he would have to make certain compromises with, quote, the powers that be. But none of us anticipated what we've seen since June 3rd. He's doing things now that he is not under any pressure to do. And those things are serving to completely alienate the base that has supported him from the start, leaving them with a very deep sense of betrayal. If this continues, we are going to have one hell of a time getting out the vote. Do you have any insight into why he is behaving the way that he is? And do you see some way to get him on track? If not, what do we do?"
Well, the Obama's particular significance should be obvious to people who think politically. The problem here is Obama is an enemy of the lower 80% of the family income brackets of the United States. Now, wait a minute, you say, wait a minute. Isn't he a black man? Was his mother a black man? I thought we got rid of this racism stuff. We don't go by race. Yeah, we go by race when we're talking about injustice against the people of a certain race, or so-called race. Yeah, that's one thing. But what's the issue? What about, so we got a lot of Hispanic Americans in this country. You notice that? And they're a little more active now than, because ever since this crazy business about faith-based initiative came along, the African-American movement has not been such a good fighting movement anymore, because they were looking up there for the cash descending upon them through the churches, rather than the cash coming into the pockets of the working people out there in the tombs. So therefore, the issue is, think politically. Don't think in racial terms. You think in racial terms when somebody is being persecuted for racial reasons. Yes, you fight that because you're fighting for humanity. You don't allow anybody to be persecuted on racial grounds. If you don't stop, if you don't oppose that, you're not human. Because human beings are all the same in terms of what their quality is. There's only one human race. There are not different races of mankind. Now, what is the problem then? The problem is that since about 1968 and the 68ers raging in the street, the lower 80% of income brackets, of family income brackets, has been pushed out. They have been used as cannon fodder on particular issues, but nobody has intended to actually get the issues important to the lower 80% of family income brackets addressed. The conditions of life in the United States since 1967, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of employment, in terms of other conditions of life, have been going down. People have been poorer, 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 more poorly educated. More education, but the quality is down. Jobs, yeah, jobs, but the jobs are crap. The purchasing power in terms of life standard, crap. So the issue has been that you have an oligarchy, a financier oligarchy, located within the upper 2% or 1.5% of population of the United States, being run from England. They think they're some kind of their extension of the British oligarchy or something, British aristocracy or whatever they call it over there. And they have been saying, we get the super incomes. Do you realize these thieves who raped the auto industry? Did you look at bonuses were on the way out, retirement bonuses? And what did they earn? They earned less than nothing. They should have paid people on the way out billions of dollars, each of them, for what they ruined. We paid them. We created an elite of money, an elite of parasites, blood-sucking parasites who wrecked our economy, who destroyed our infrastructure, who destroyed our industries, who destroyed our education system, who destroying our pension system, who condemn people who are now baby boomer generation entering retirement age. Their pensions are being taken away from them by these policies. And these characters have been running the United States. So what's the issue? The issue is we once had a republic, the most powerful economy on this planet, the greatest rate of improvement of any part of the planet. What happened to it? Well, you had Truman first. That wasn't good. Then after they killed Kennedy, it got worse. Then after the 68ers, it got terrible. Then after the election of Nixon, it became impossible. By the election of Carter, we'd lost everything. And so, therefore, people have become poorer, 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 looted, cheated in every possible way. Cheated of their dignity, not just their financial status. What's the issue? The issue is identity. The issue is, what am I? What are my children? What are my friends? What are they? Are they human or not? Don't they have a right to be represented? Don't they have a right as human beings to have a claim on improvements and access to things that are human? We're talking about a two-class system, essentially, some parasites at top with all the money who don't actually earn anything, but get more. Their money is in inverse proportion to what they earn. The more worthless they are, the bigger the salary. We have destroyed the identity. Look at our children. Look at young people in Facebook or MySpace and similar kinds of ghettos of stupidity and degradation. Look at them. They're in the age group of 18 to 25. Look at them. What's their future? Killer games? Killing each other en masse? Suicide killings? We have destroyed our people. We have destroyed their human identity. And what do you need? You need to have the lower 20% or 80% of family income brackets represented in the sense that they assemble and can ask themselves, one another, and our society, what does it mean for us to be human in this society? Forget race. Let's talk about human. Human race. And you find that we have the lower 80% and even much of the upper 20% have their lives been taken away from them. Look what now threatens the baby boomer generation entering retirement age. What about their health care? What about their pensions? What's being said about that? The problem is when we are producing less and less, the standard of living, the available physical standard of living is degenerating. Why? Because somebody has a utopian conception of the type like the WTO, things like that. So therefore, if you want to have representative government, you can't have representative in the sense of, well, we all have a chance to vote, to speak our piece and cast our vote. That's not representative government. That's brainwashing. Representative government is understanding what it is to be human and not a monkey. And to understand the kind of society, the kind of life, the kind of organization of life which is required to be human, not a monkey, or treated as a monkey. And that's what was not presented. You got a quarter of $1 billion for a campaign of a poor man's candidate. The biggest sum of money ever assembled for a political candidate, presidential candidate in the history of the United States, and still growing. Who does he represent? What does he represent? So that's the problem. That we have to realize that the presidency of the United States, the selection of the president of the United States, begins with those who include the poorest, more poorly educated people of the United States. Because what you're doing for the people and for their children in that lowest condition of life in our country tells me what you think human values are. If you're not changing that, and if you're not fighting to change that, and clearing up the questions on that subject, you're not a leader. Or you shouldn't pretend to be a leader. Because we are losing everything this country once stood for. Even as recently as the end of the war, even as recently as the time of the assassination of Jack Kennedy. We're losing it all. We're losing the moral values of being human. And therefore you get what? Immoral presidents, immoral candidates. You get the worst idiot the United States ever conceived in politics, and he's been the president for 2 terms. God, what's wrong with us?
For those of you who are listening via the internet, you're listening to a live broadcast from Washington, D.C. by Lyndon LaRouche. And if you have questions, you can submit them, and we will try to get to them in turn. Lynn, the next question is from a former member of Congress who says, Mr. LaRouche, despite Obama's arrogant confidence that black Americans will turn out in record numbers to vote for him, a deep split is forming in the black community. with those of us whose roots are in the civil rights movement on one side and those younger black professionals who've enjoyed the benefits of that movement on the other. If the Democrats don't make some very fast changes, this presidential election will have the lowest turnout in our history, and we could end up with a McCain presidency and, even worse, a Republican Congress. What do you recommend in terms of specific action and measures to stop this from happening? Specifically, what I'm asking you is, should we just concentrate on getting the right people elected to the House and Senate?
No, it won't work. You need a president. Otherwise, it won't happen. But there's an. Continuing, because these questions are all related, let me just continue another aspect of what I've already said so far. I won't repeat. Not necessary. Let's talk about faith-based initiative as a corrupt factor of corruption introduced from the Republican Party to try to destroy the African-American effort in the United States. And let's talk about inclusively those members who are leading members of the electoral body of state level and so forth in the freedom movement who went over and became corrupted by faith-based initiative and became useless as a result. Now, this is a sensitive subject, but it's an important one, because if you don't consider it, you're not considering the problem. What about religion? How do people allow their religious attachments to churches to corrupt them politically and morally? And the problem here is, in the churches, you have people who have enthusiasm of one form or the other, but they don't believe in immortality. They believe in a fairy story called immortality. They don't understand and don't recognize what's most essential for leadership in society, that man is not a monkey, man is not a great ape. That man has immortality as no monkey does. But it's not immortality in some crazy, fantastic way. It's in a very real way. We as human beings have a power called creativity, which is typified by the creative discovery of principles of universal physical science. No animal can do that. You know, if you for example, take of the population of the higher apes at its maximum. Gorillas, chimpanzees, so forth. What was the population density of these populations on this planet? Now, what is the history of the size of the human population on this planet? We're now over 6.5 billion people. And though some imitate monkeys, they're not monkeys. What's the difference? Some of our citizens look like monkeys, or look like gorillas, or look like some baboons or something. Act like baboons, seemingly. They're not baboons. Why do those people who sometimes act like baboons have a higher potential population density than baboons? Because of the human mind. The identity of the human individual lies in the creative powers of the human mind, which do not exist in the animal. That the ideas that we generate through creativity, transmitted to coming generations, live on with our personality embossed upon them into future generations. This cultural development of mankind, both in as exist simply in physical science, in other ways, is human nature, is the expression of the individual human soul. And it's this sense, effectively, with people who are faced with death because of old age, disease, and so forth, and they look around at their family, their friends, and so forth, what do they think when they know they are faced with death? What do they think their life means? For what would they lay down their life and feel that that was an affirmation of themselves as human? This source of corruption is a lack of a sense of that kind, that sense of immortality. Not that you, somebody picks you up and transports you someplace else and you get this or that forever. But the sense that you, by participating in humanity, have a quality which no animal has. A power of creativity. A power to absorb the creative contributions of those who went before you. To make them live. To add to that. So that your imprint, whether your name is remembered or not, your imprint is there in society. You were a necessary existence. Now, when you see yourself in those terms, you have a great deal of power as a personality. Not power over people, but power, a power to be human. Pride of being human. Meaning of life. If life is short, that's painful, but that doesn't change you. It doesn't take away your value. Your value lies in the fact that you are a useful, necessary human being. And sometimes even the loving relationship among human beings does that. It's creative. What do you mean, what's the difference between love and sex? It's creativity. That creative quality in yourself. Loving people because you resonate with something in them that is creative. And that's what you prize, that you're willing to die for that. You don't want to die, but that's what you'll die for. And the problem here is that we have this great hypocrisy, which is symbolized by those who went from civil rights fighters into the faith-based initiative. The greatness is going to descend upon us from above. And Karl Rove is going to cause it to be dropped on us. And that's what the problem is. Is we don't, you will not get in society generally people who have that quality of sense of identity as creative persons. But if you look at history and you look at what we know among people around us in politics and in science and other things, it is the few people in society who have a sense of commitment to humanity in those terms of reference, who are the actual leaders who do the good, which the others adopt and follow. Leadership in society is not the power over others. Leadership in society is having a sense of what a human being is, a stronger sense, a better affirmation of the sense of what it is to be human than somebody else. And because you are stronger emotionally, stronger intellectually, you can pick up people who have fallen and help them rise to what they're potentially capable of. And they need you for that. And that's the secret. And that's the secret of real politics. I think we ought to throw that into the pot as we're discussing candidates.
Mr. LaRouche, a good number of very active Democrats understand very well that contrary to what one reads in the press and sees on TV, the Democratic nominee for President of the United States has not yet been selected. Your feature film, 1932, helps teach people this, and links to it, as well as the film itself, are being posted all over the internet. I just wanted to mention to you that we appreciate the fact that you've produced it. As you know, scores of grassroots organizations have sprung up all over the United States whose intention it is to guarantee an open Democratic convention. Right now, we're not getting much in the way of guidance from the Clinton campaign, and without it, it's very hard to maintain a sense of optimism that we can prevail. Do you think that there really is any chance at all of Hillary recapturing the Democratic nomination? If so, how? And if not, what to do?
Well, the point is, I don't think that question has been settled at all. I don't think it's settled. Look what's happening this week. Look at the events around you. You have, for example, this spokesman for the Daily Telegraph, Ambrose Evan Pritchett, just this weekend put out and said, "This is it, buddy. This is the end." And he's right. He's wrong in the way he interprets it, but he's right. This is the end. People are talking about, well, it's all settled. This is by the end of, the beginning of September, it's all going to be clear. We're going to have McCain versus Obama, and Obama's going to win. What crap? You're having people out there, like many of these Democrats you referred to that you questioned, who are organizing in groups. Why? Because reality is not leadership from Hillary at this point, and probably she's right in terms of judgment of just lay back, because the way the whole thing was set up was to use her as a target to destroy any perception of the issues of the campaign. And staying back for a while and letting things sink in, let Obama look bad, and then come back. That's not, or decide what to do. Decide whether just to stick with the idea of being in the Senate, and being, because she would be the most powerful person in the Senate if she were in the Senate under these conditions. She's earned the points on that. So let's not assume that there's a linear trend in the candidacy now. There isn't. Look what's just happening now. Look at what's happening with the bank. Wachovia. What do you think Wachovia's collapse is going to mean around the country just now? Obama's off there talking about this in Afghanistan. He doesn't know what Afghanistan is. He probably thinks a bunch of hound dogs over there, Afghan hounds or something. He doesn't know anything about that. But what about Wachovia? The largest bank in terms of these outlets in the United States. And it's gone down the pit. Do you know how many other banks are in a similar condition in the United States? Do you know how rapidly this crash is coming on now? Do you know what's happening in Spain? Do you know what's happening in England? Do you know what's happening on the continent of Europe? Do you know what's happening in Italy and France? Yeah. The world is changing rapidly. So the world you lived in yesterday is no longer the world you're living in today. And people are more concerned. What's Afghanistan? Afghanistan is 1 acre, as given to me recently, 1 acre of poppies in Afghanistan has a market of $600. By the time the product of that 1 acre reaches Europe or the United States, it's $6 million. What is Afghanistan? It's dope heaven. Who's running it? The British. The British Empire is running it. This idiot wants to talk about, he's working for the British. What's he want to talk about Afghanistan for? What's he know about Afghanistan? He doesn't know anything about Afghanistan. It's a British operation. Go talk to the Russians. What is Afghanistan? It's dope. Especially went through Russia, especially during the 1990s. Dope. What's Afghanistan in Europe? Dope. Dope empires. And so under these conditions, the changes that are affecting the lives and emotions of people, including sentient people inside the United States, are coming on fast. And what happened in Wachovia's circuits yesterday, today, and tomorrow is far more important in determining the attitudes of the American people on the coming election than anything that Obama did in the Near East. Because it's nothing. There's a smell of fakery. He's not addressing it. It's not that just Wachovia is an issue, but if the entire financial system of the United States is collapsing around your ears and you're a presidential candidate, what the hell has Afghanistan got to do with your life? There's no reason to go over there and fight in Afghanistan. It's stupid if you go in there that way. You have to know what the issues are first. You have to know what the British are playing a game against India and they're trying to destroy Pakistan. That's all part of it. So that's the point. Don't get trapped into this. Worry about this. Yeah, we don't know what the outcome is going to be. We don't know who's going to win. But do we know what we're going to fight about? Do we know what the battle is? Do we have a policy for fighting that battle, that war? And like in fighting any war, a long war, for example. This is a part of a long war against dope. You have to decide what your policy is and stick to it. And right now, the big issue is the international financial problem. And the key issue of Afghanistan is, one, is strategic. It's a threat to all Asia as a focal point of destabilization. But it also is a part of the international drug operation. It's a part of the British Empire's game against the world. And here it is. On the streets of the United States, what is Afghanistan? It's Wachovia.
Lynn, we still have a number of questions from Washington, D.C., dealing with this issue. But we also have, in very stark contrast, questions coming in from elected officials around the country who are faced more with managing the crisis on a day-to-day basis. And their questions tend to be a little bit more reality-oriented. We also, though, have, for the first time, a number of students listening from around the nation of Yemen. And one of them has submitted a question, and since it's very late there, I wanted to ask you the question, and then we'll get back to the American elected officials. Sam's question is as follows. He says, "Dear Mr. LaRouche, salam alaikum. I hope you are in good health, and may God give you a long life." Sam, I couldn't agree with you more. Maybe people in the United States and Europe still don't understand the danger of the ongoing collapse that you're warning about. But here in third world countries, people are not fighting to defend a standard of living. We are fighting to provide ourselves with the most basic necessities for surviving. And we're starving and we are suffering to death from this economic collapse. Could you please tell us what we should do in our countries and in third world countries? Is there any hope for us at all, any hope for help from the United States as it's currently, as the U.S. is currently constituted? Best regards and wishes, Sam.
Well, as I've indicated earlier, I think, on some of the discussion here today, that you cannot effectively defend your own country if you're not concerned about humanity as a whole and nations as a whole. This comes up, for example, in all these debates in Europe where the British Empire is trying to create a new Tower of Babel. And of course, they already achieved one. It's called the Parliament. But we have to have that solidarity, a sense of solidarity with people of other parts of the world. We have to be responsive. I mean, we have a lot of African countries, for example, which, you know, most Americans don't know a damn thing about Africa. Some of them think they do, but they don't know it. They think it's a collection of fairy stories to them. It's not real. They don't understand the problem. But what's needed is essentially understanding of what the problem is, as this message from Yemen indicates. It's extremely important to have on the agenda an understanding of what these kinds of problems are in various areas. I mean, it's what I do all the time in doing strategic assessments. You just take the total picture and you try to make sense about what all the issues and forces are in a certain area of the world and how they interact. And interaction involves the condition of people. I mean, we've been at it a long time in Africa. That's why I'd say people in the United States, you know, so-called African-Americans, don't know a damn thing about Africa. They don't know about the reality of Africa. And those of us who are involved in looking at this strategically do know. We know what this horror show is. And we know what the Europeans and the people in the United States are doing about that. What they're doing. The crimes that are being committed in the name of the United States against the population of sub-Saharan Africa is beyond belief. And it comes right out of some of our liberals here in the United States too. And friends of Al Gore, for example. Al Gore hates Africans. And that's a fact you got to know to understand the world. So we do have to, in answer to your question, we do have to, and we try to do that with our resources and with our intelligence estimates. We do get in fairly deeply into the problems of sections of society in various parts of the world. We do attempt to correlate these studies of what's happening. We do have compassion, and sometimes agonized compassion, for what's happening to people in various parts of the world today. That right now is the best we can do. But it's something we must do, because if we lose sight of the mission, any part of the mission we have in the planet, we've lost our competence. It's to the degree that we are able to understand and feel for what is happening in various parts of the world and understand those issues. Like the case of hunger, like this food crisis, that alone. Take the food crisis. Do you realize there are people in the world who have one meal a day and it's a terrible meal and they're losing that? Do you realize how many people there are in the world of that type? Do you realize how ignorant the American people are of that in general? They don't even know what that means. Do you realize what the food policy, the WTO means in terms of mass murder of people in various parts of this world? You know what Al Gore means in terms of the mass death that he alone causes with his policies through his influence in the United States and elsewhere? His British policies? No, we have to have, as you indicate, we have to have an efficient commitment, a commitment known to the people, as in Yemen, that we have that commitment, that whatever we're able to do or not able to do now, we have that commitment and we will not forget it.
Then the next question is from Representative Yusuf Abdussalam from Selma, Alabama. He's a member of the Alabama House of Representatives, and he's also a practicing attorney in Selma. He says, Mr. LaRouche, my question is, we seem to have a complete disconnect. The nation is in the midst of a major economic crisis. And yet our leaders, Mr. Paulson, Mr. Bernanke, and others, deny this and insist, quote, the fundamentals are sound, everything's fine, we can handle the current crisis because the economy is fundamentally strong. Here we have a great crisis, perhaps the greatest crisis we've ever faced. They say we don't. So how could they even deal with it if they don't acknowledge it? It seems to me that this is the time to acknowledge the success of FDR and enact a Roosevelt policy to really rally this nation to save itself. My question, though, is why are these men in denial about the crisis? Are they really? And why won't they grasp a solution that is at hand?
Well, in case, the problem is generational. What's this generation? It's a baby boomer. Now, does he actually believe that? I don't think he does believe that. I don't think he believes a bit of it. Does he believe he has to say it? Yes. In his official position, speaking publicly, does he have to say that? He thinks so. Does he believe it? No. That's typical. This is typical in the Congress, as I think the questioner knows. I'm dealing with from law down in that neck of the woods. The Congress is a bunch of hypocrites. You can't say that. Yes, it's true. I agree. But if you tell me that I said it, I'll say you are a liar. That's go along to get along. Lie your heads off. And so don't hold people accountable necessarily for what they say they believe, because they know better than to believe anything they hear themselves saying. And the only way to deal with them, I think, is to tell them that.
Caitlin, we have several questions all kind of grouped together from Representative Priscilla Taylor from West Palm Beach, Florida. She is she was the person who introduced the HBPA into the Florida legislature during the last session. She says, Mr. LaRouche, I have several questions for you. Since your last webcast, the economy is really in a mess. The government and the Federal Reserve seem to have no problems at all bailing out Bear Stearns and other banks, and seem to now be considering a massive bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Yet, in our area and around the country, the poor homeowner is losing his or her home at record rates. All we're getting from the federal government is that they're going to send us money to fix the neighborhoods where the foreclosures and repossessions are occurring, i.e. to deal with the vacancies. What good will this do us? Absolutely none. Wouldn't it be better to keep families in their homes in the first place? It's why I was so happy with your idea of a freeze on foreclosures, which I would like to note was also picked up by Senator Clinton, who I've always supported. Congress is doing it backwards. Let people stay in their homes first, and then deal with the banking crisis. My question is this. The press keeps saying that the economy is undergoing a correction and that that's going to end soon. But I'm curious because I see no end to the correction. I see nothing over the horizon but disaster. When do you think this is going to end? And finally, how are we going to fix our credit system? You say that there's a huge credit bubble, but people can't get credit for businesses, for their homes, or for anything vital. It seems to be all stalled. How do we fix this?
Well, you know, I can imagine in the course of the French terror, you know, these people are lined up one after the other going to the guillotine. And the one is saying to the other, don't worry, this is just a correction. It's what's that?
That was a correction.
Someone trying to get ahead, huh? No, the point, you have these people doing all these things, and you really have to get Charles Adams type humor going to describe your reaction to what you're hearing sometimes. You know, you have this image of a man furiously bailing out a bottomless boat. And that's what it amounts to. Don't worry, we're trying. This is only temporary. We're trying. Look, we got a lot out right now. Look, we're trying. And that's what they're doing. Again, they're lying. They're lying. They want to stay in the club. Therefore, they have to sound like they're with the club. Our club says this is only a correction. Oh, really? Is that what they're saying? Yeah. Okay, it's only a correction, fellas. That's the problem. And what the only answer is, and people who have get into these kinds of fights that are described in this question sometimes don't get into the big fights. And then they get into the fight from the level they've been fighting on before, and they're willing to accept a little tougher fight, a little stiffer one. But then they find out they have to go up to a much bigger level, a higher level, because the fight is much bigger than they ever thought it was. And the fact is, it always was that. So the problem is getting stuck with the idea that doing a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, what seems practical to do, is really the step toward progress. It's not. When the whole is bigger than the bottom of the boat, bailing is no good. What you're expressing, as many people are expressing now, especially since this hoax about Obama's guaranteed nomination, a complete fake. But there was a mass chorus saying, "Oh, he's nominated. He's nominated. He's nominated. Anybody who says so differently is lying." That people are intimidated by that. And that's what, in a sense, frightens them. But then, there is in the course of events, there are processes which overturn all such follies. And we're going through it now. And what happened is the questioner is getting a dose of a bigger problem than they wanted to get into. That you cannot do anything about a situation in the state of Florida without cleaning up the mess in Washington at the top. And that's where the problem comes. That's where the hole gets bigger than the boat. And that's it really is stunning to deal with. Because, see, most local leaders, that is people on a state level and so forth, congressmen, even federal congressmen, they're used to fighting in a certain way. They think about practicalities, as they would call it. And they find suddenly that an issue they have to deal with, which at first seems to them to be typical of the kind of practical issues they fight about. Welfare of people, people being kicked out of their homes, this sort of problem, shortage of food, sickness, this sort of thing. They're used to that. But then they find that the issue becomes systemic. So it looks like the same particular issue that the politician would fight for in his district. But now we realize it's not something that's in his district. It's the whole damn nation is the problem. And that's a shock. At that point, you realize that you need to think in terms of developing national and international organization. You have to get a bucket that's big enough, bigger than the hole. And that's the problem. I think we're doing it. I think this is in process. I'm not a person who guarantees simple victories. I don't predict who's going to win this or who's winning that. I'm too old. I'm too wise to do that. But I do know that when you're fighting a war against an enemy, you better get the forces in line which are capable of taking on that kind of war and define the war and its implications first and then decide what it's going to require to win it.
Okay, as I said, we have a lot more questions from various people in the United States, from various elected officials in the United States, but we do also have questions that are coming in from abroad, and I'm going to kind of jumpstart to some of those while those people are still awake, and then we'll come back to the questions from the Americans. This question is submitted I'm asking it because it's from England. It's from John Morton. He says, "Mr. LaRouche, my name is John Morton, and I'm a writer for a newspaper called the UK Column, which is based out of Plymouth in England. I've been following your forecasts and warnings for some years now, and I've taken a keen interest in your analysis of the situation both in the US and Europe, particularly in respect to the economic and political effects of globalization. You may or may not be aware of it, but here in the UK, a gentleman by the name of Mr. John Harris has taken it upon himself to submit sworn affidavits to Queen Elizabeth under Article 61 of the Magna Carta 1215 for redress of grievances. The specific charge is that Her Majesty the Queen dismiss all traitors in the Parliament who are currently engaged in handing our sovereignty over to a foreign power, namely the European Union. As of Sunday, a video has been posted, and it reports a conversation between the editor of our newspaper, Mr. Brian Gerrish, and a certain Mrs. Sonia Bonici, who is a corresponding agent at Buckingham Palace. What this conversation reveals is that the palace is indeed aware that treason is being committed in respect to the ratification of the Lisbon Treaty, and also that all matters related to the European Union are automatically forwarded to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office rather than being addressed directly by our sovereign. As such, as far as we can ascertain from our study of British constitutional history, the UK is now in the midst of a constitutional crisis of historic proportions. As you are no doubt aware, the denotice system prevents matters dealing with national security from being reported in the British media, and it's therefore unlikely that mainstream media in the UK can or will report on these matters. But nonetheless, in the spirit of the Pilgrim Fathers who departed these shores only a few miles from where I pen this question today, we would be very much interested to hear your comments on these developments and explain what prospects exist for a restoration of sovereignty and democracy in England in view of international developments, particularly around your proposals for a new Bretton Woods.
Well, I should qualify my response for obvious reasons, one of which I should point out, is that I am, of course, descended in one part of my family from people from that neck of the woods, especially from Lancashire, who went from ports like that into New England during the first half of the 17th century. And then at about the same time, we had some people from France sent by a great man to Canada, Quebec. So the principal part of the family comes from both from Quebec, the first half of the 17th century, and from Massachusetts, the first half of the 17th century. So I have, and also some fellow in who's a specialist in genealogy has been trying to hook me up with descent from Henry II and Henry I and things like that. So I say, okay, that's the case. Then if I have to take care for you, my descendants or something. My family's descendants in England. Well, we'll try to help you out on these matters a bit, you know. Yes, I think the solution, essentially, which you've been implying with your line of your argument, is that obviously the Isles ought to be a separate country, a sovereign nation with its own sovereignty. And I would propose that meddling in imperial matters, as which you refer to, for example, has resulted in a weakening of the quality of life in what would be called, for example, the mother country. And I think England would be much better off or the United Kingdom, much better off as a single sovereign nation, or three happily coexisting nations of England, Wales, and Scotland, than it would be as part of an empire. I think the empire is dragging the English down, and the Scottish, and probably the Welsh too. I haven't had much reports from Wales, but I do have a lot of Scottish reports. And I do believe that the empire is dragging the island down. And I think we look forward to the time that we in the United States can rejoice in sort of a fraternal union with our friends there, who have now become what we have become, a sovereign nation state republic.
Okay, one more international question, because we're getting a huge number of these from the other side of the Atlantic, from Africa, and also from the United States. Lynn, it's about the ICC's indictment of President al-Bashir of Sudan. The various questioners are saying there seems to be a tremendous effort to mess up this area. There has been for quite some time. What is really behind the indictment of President Bashir, since it does not seem to have any basis in international law?
Of course it doesn't, but it has a good deal of basis in terms of imperialism, doesn't it? And it also has a great deal to do with racism against Africa, racism which is led by the United Kingdom, or led from the United Kingdom. The case of Bashir, look, Bashir I've met him. I know the situation there. It's complicated by French policies of a really archaic type. You have a country adjoining from French, so-called French Central Africa, which adjoins Sudan, and most of the mess in Darfur comes from operations run through that country. So that you have complications. You have the British on the one hand. The British are out to destroy Zimbabwe. You cannot separate Zimbabwe from Sudan in this matter. Remember that Zimbabwe's freedom, it was the flagship of the Rhodes Empire. And not only was that, but this section, which is now Zimbabwe today, was the most hard-fought resistance against the British Empire in southern Africa. It was also, Zimbabwe was a source of the great food supply for London. And you had the choicest areas from the days of Rhodes, and the choicest areas for crops were these controlled by Dutch and English, who still control the food supply of London and similar places. Then the African farmer who has a smaller plot adjacent to the same kind of territory that the English lord has is considered is in resentment against this, and it's a threat both ways. So the British are determined to crush that, to crush Mbeki, to crush South Africa, to crush every part of Africa, to ruin Nigeria, and so forth. That's the policy, the British policy. In the case of Sudan, you have to know Sudan. Now, Sudan's importance is the Nile Water Agreements involving principally Egypt, Sudan, and Abyssinia. The Blue Nile, the White Nile come together, and then you get now the area of Nubia, which is the northern part of Sudan. Remember, this is the largest area in Africa in terms of territory. It's the largest part, single nation of Africa. This area, properly developed with a certain amount of water management, is historically a grain-producing area on which much of the population of the whole region depends. For example, the development of Egypt's food supply depends to a large degree on the success of getting a certain amount of water and management in there. Now, also, there's another issue. You have one of the most important influences in Africa today is China. China, of all countries outside of Africa, China has made the steadiest, most significant contribution to the development of the economy and infrastructure of southern African states, especially on the relevant side, that is on the Indian Ocean side. So China has been an important factor in developing the infrastructure of Sudan. So there is a direct relationship between the Tibet issue in China from London and the issue of China's role in developing the infrastructure of Sudan, along with the determination to crush Egypt again, another blow, and to stir up as much bloodshed throughout all of Africa as possible. This is a policy we know very well from 1974-75 as a U.S. and British policy. So you've got a bunch of damn racist Brits who are out there to screw up this whole territory any way they can. Now, we've got a response on this. The African states, not all of whom are in the best moral condition in terms of government, know this, understand this, and tend to ally and block the British effort against British genocide in Africa. And the London policy in Africa is genocide, rape in terms of raw materials and genocide. And that's what it is. And the Europeans go along with this. Not entirely. The French get corrupted because, like this case of Chad. Chad is a so-called British interest state. And that's one of the reasons. That's why the Darfur problem came about the way it did, because of this relationship. So they're out to screw it up. And European are gutless. Not all of them, but most of them are gutless now. And they don't take a moral position. Well, we have to get along with the British. After all, the Maastricht Agreement, which is our friend from Plymouth said, is that we got horses? What? Okay. Anyway, so that's the problem, and that's the way to look at it. You're getting a real sense of British imperial racism, and I just indicated a couple of the leading factors in this thing. But the racism is against all Africa. Keep the population of Africa down. Do everything possible to injure China, et cetera, et cetera. That's what happens. We need the United States to be strong again.
Okay, back to the United States. Lynn, this is a question from a Washington think tank. He says, Lynn, as I think you are aware, a serious split is emerging between the banks on the one hand and Wall Street on the other. Can you help your listeners understand why the split is occurring and whether or not it can be exploited for the good of the nation?
First of all, you have two types of banks principally to consider. You also have a complication of hybrids where banks have a double character. You have, on the one hand, you have the bank which is a part of the Federal Reserve System or just simply normal by previous standards, a federal or state chartered banks which take deposits, which have capital funds, which conduct business in terms of clientele like corporations and so forth and make loans of all kinds. Then you have these hybrid crites, which are simply swindlers. Now, this kind of hybrid operation, which has been around for a long time in one sense, got a new lease on life with Michael Milken, who went from prison to serenity when he was reincarnated as Alan Greenspan. So what has happened, and so you have a similar thing in London, so you have another kind of banking, which is purely predatory banking of the type of the swindle that Greenspan introduced in a massive way into the U.S. system, which is the special characteristic of our problem today. That's where the big swindle is. You see, the way it works is you manufacture fictitious capital. If you get a yield you think you're getting, and you put that yield at 5% or 7%, then you will take the capital multiple of an annual yield of 5 to 7%, and you will call that an asset. So what happens is the more they steal, the bigger the appetite for stealing. And the bigger the claim that they make as finance capital claims against the economy. So my view is do the equivalent of taking this kind of banking out in the backyard and shoot it. And save the bank which does the traditional banking function, which was at the center of doing that. Is since the Federal Reserve System is now essentially bankrupt, as the case of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac illustrates the point, therefore we have to put the Federal Reserve System into receivership under federal law, but keep it operating and keep the Federal Reserve System operating in terms of its component banks while we're running it under management and receivership. By this method and by the generality of chartered banks, state and federal, we should be able to create a banking system within the banking system. This is why this countrywide is such a swindle. We want to take the trash out and leave the edibles behind. And that's what we're going to have to do. So it's not a category of banks against some other banks. The point is you've got a mixed situation where you have some people think this crazy system is what they're defending. And also, since some of these guys are powerful, the thieves, the Michael Milken descendants, the Alan Greenspan, are powerful, they exert a great political power in the system because they manufacture money out of manure. And they say, we're wealthy, therefore you have to protect our interests. These financial interests are ours. This is ours. You've got to save the capitalist system. We're the big people in the capitalist system. Without us, you're nothing. You have to defend us. And I say, no, we don't have to defend you. You know, we used to put the manure. We had a manure pile. And we didn't mix up what the feed for the cows with the manure pile. And that's the way you have to look at this. Those institutions which will perform, will behave themselves, which are essential to our economy, should come under federal protection and go back and do what they used to do fairly well. The ones that don't do that, we put them on the manure pile. And that's the way we keep the barn smelling better.
Okay, the next question is from Senator Perry Clark in Louisville, Kentucky. Senator Clark is one of the co-sponsors of the HBPA in the Kentucky Senate, and he did actually succeed in getting it passed during the last session. He says, Lynn, boy, what a mess the economy is in. The crisis is on top of us. What are the real issues? Food, clothing, the economy, clothes, jobs. This thing is coming down, and it's coming down fast. Yet, what are people talking about? Lapel pins, gay marriage, diversions. How are we going to move people? I agree with your estimate that we're in the middle of both an economic unraveling, but also of an ongoing tragedy. Certainly since Nixon, this economy has been deteriorating. And yet, people are deep into distractions. This is clearly the time to move around a Roosevelt package, around the HBPA, around the emergency jobs program. I just don't get it. How can we cut through the psychological denial and escapism to move the public? This is a time when people should be supporting your policies and the FDR approach in droves. But how do we teach them that? Also, I just wanted to say that I am appalled at the blocking being done by Speaker Pelosi and others in Congress who seem to be working to stop any sane economic solution. I'm well aware of her connection to both George Soros and Felix Rohatyn, but the woman has an approval rating of 5%. Nevertheless, are members of Congress that scared of her manicured hand and her expressionless glare?
Well, on the general issue, the point is, as you can see, when you look at the national scene, that what was done to the Hillary campaign has unleashed something like a swarm of locusts, because everyone knows that power does not lie primarily at the state level or local level. Power lies in determining the policies of the federal government. And it's a political fight over the policies of the federal government that will get the most credible kind of response from the population. What you've had is that women in particular and others who had this response are reflecting something lawful. Many of the women who are leading in these kinds of operations, as I pick up the word on these things, were political beforehand, but they weren't political leaders. They didn't think of themselves as political leaders. They thought of themselves as responding to political issues, as housewives or so forth. But now they become firebrands, political firebrands, and they're fighters. But I think the issue has made that. The threat to society is grave. And the perception is that only at the federal level can you break the ice on this one. Therefore, you need a national movement, a national leadership, a national focus in order to get the local and state interest into focus. Without a nationwide national focus, I think it's impossible to do it. I think the time of base building from the bottom up is ended. And base building in an empty boat is not a hollow boat, a bottomless boat, is not a very good project. And that's what it is today. Because you can't float anything down any stream or across any pond in a bottomless boat. And to have a non-bottomless boat, you've got to attack the thing at the issue, at the federal level, on the issue of federal level. And therefore, the politics of federal politics is naturally the issue which is decisive. Look, you can't do anything about the local bank without federal action. There's nothing you can do about any of the major issues without attacking it on a federal level. And I think these women and others who are doing what they're doing are simply responding rationally to the fact that if you're going to do anything, don't kid yourself that you're going to do something in a local community, like socialism in one telephone booth or something like that. It's going to be essentially you're going to attack the issue on a national basis, and you're going to define the issues which most broadly address the concerns of the population in general. You've got to move the population to break the ice. It's the population as a whole. You've got to find the stratum in the population and move that to break the ice. When people see it moving, then they'll get the courage to come out and fight. It's always like that.
I understand that there's someone here from the UAW in Delphi, Ohio. There's still a UAW? You want to come up to the mic? This is Mark Swayze, ladies and gentlemen.
Lynn, obviously the reason I'm here today is to say thank you to you. I want to thank you for all your past efforts and your constituents as well, because with your predictions of what was going to take place in the auto industry, and extremely accurate as it was, we were able to do nothing more than find escape routes for our members. And the escape route that I found was that I learned a lot about the federal government in the probably year and a half that I was coming to Washington. I think it's 10 times total. So I thought it would be good if the federal government paid up and made do for those people that were going to be displaced and lose their jobs at an early age, as I did. I retired early, so I thought maybe the youth group would pick me up, but... But we were the first local union to get the Trade Adjustment Act in Columbus, Ohio. And with that, it expanded to an international union and asked me, how'd you get this? So we explained it to them, I explained it to them, sent them the application, and now millions of dollars of federal monies have helped some of our people relocate, re-educate them, get them new jobs, different vocations, what have you. So I learned a lot by just being here, but just listening to you and understanding scares me to death today, because I don't want to see these predictions come true today. What I saw in the past is extremely accurate, and what's come to pass has affected thousands and thousands of lives. But what I see today is hundreds of thousands and millions of lives. This thing goes beyond, as Lynn's explained, beyond the United States of America. And you know, an old Greek proverb says, there's nothing more frightening than ignorance in action. Well, I'd like to change that to an American proverb. There's nothing more frightening with ignorance without action. Lynn can't do this by himself. We're going to have to help him. Anybody that's on this webcast, whomever, wherever, write to our Congress, your own congressman, another congressman, a friend. Have your neighbors help out. Let's get on the ball. Let's make this thing roll. Put this thing together. Otherwise, just as Lynn says, we're all going to be bailing from the same boat with no hope. I want to be on his life raft. Thanks again. Thanks again, Lynn.
Thank you.
Lynn, the next question is from somebody who really doesn't need an introduction. Apparently, she wants me to ask the question. Barbara, where are you? This is from, there you are. You want me to ask it? Or do you want to come up to the mic?
No, I thought it was saving time for you asking.
Oh, come on up to the mic. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Barbara Lett Simmons, a longtime member of the Democratic National Committee, the only member of the Electoral College who voted against Al Gore during the course of the Y2K election. And a true heroine to many of us here in the district. Barbara, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. I just want to, I have so many concerns in terms of our future. So many people have worked so hard, so long. I'm now 81, and I spent my 80th birthday in China. And I said, what on earth is happening to us in America? If we aren't expediting with the leadership we've had in our presidency for the last 8 years, we're expediting our own demise. And I find it frightening because I'm old enough to have been there when our concern was in America for people who looked like me not having any kind of freedom, any kind of access, and at best, a hard row to hoe. And here we work like crazy. We get America moving to accept its precepts and to act upon them. And kaputs. We turn the country over to some people that are going to absolutely, or who have practically destroyed it. I can't write now because the residual of my stroke, but I just wanted, I couldn't help but think, Lynn, it seems to me that the kind of work and thinking and solutions that you have shared with people in this country in high places, that the kind of demise I see for our country ought not to happen, because you have given them the word, and it's possible that we could reverse having what seems inevitable at the moment. We know that Obama, Barack was on Christmas, when most people are with their families, he was over at Mr. Soros' house. Now that ought to register a real question mark in almost anybody's head. I mean, you know, as mothers, we all spend a lot of our time trying to keep track of who our kids are playing with. That is very important. And people don't know who Barack's been playing with, but it's sure showing. And the way he's reversing everything, oh, man, he comes out with a good facade. But, you know, don't scrape any of the paint off. Tell me, I was really sincere about trying to make a point when I refused to cast my ballot as a member of the Electoral College, and my own city, the powers that be had decided that they were not going to send my ballot in. I said, "You can't do that. What are you talking about? I'm an elector, and I have a right to my ballot. And my ballot is going to be blank. I am not voting for Al Gore." I said, "And in order for the world to know that we are still a colony in the District of Columbia, this will be one way of educating a lot of people in a hurry, because I couldn't get 20 people to sit in a room and listen to that. It's kind of boring discussion." A lot of people across this world heard it. I heard from China. I heard from Japan. I heard from France. I heard from, I think altogether, 11 nations, people from other nations, internationally. They said they just did not believe that the citadel of democracy, there is a congregation, there are people, residents of over 750,000 people who don't even have the right to vote. And everyone here is sophisticated and knows that. But look at the worlds of people who don't. Lynn, I really wanted to ask you, do you believe that if we do not, I think what I've been doing is doing a poll. I've just been calling people. Though that is super delegates. And a lot of super delegates. You know, it's very easy. You know, you mentioned it. You made a very excellent point here about how easy it is for people to lie, you know? And when we ask people here, now all of the press, they got all these figures that say Obama is without question. He told us how many votes he had. Well, I don't believe it, because my figures are sure different. Now, they're lying to them, or they're lying to me, and I don't know. I'm not going to pretend that I know that I have the real figures. I'm saying that there are votes enough for Hillary to still be the viable candidate when we get to the convention, because she has not released her delegates. Would you just speak for a minute to that point and tell us, maybe I need to have some little hope and something to hang on to.
I think it's... I think that's the case, exactly the case. You know, the thug squads came in and told people, you will not deny that you cast this vote as a superdelegate, which is crazy anyway. I mean, a premature casting of a vote. You've got the time to cast the vote. The convention's the place that's supposed to cast the vote with a discussion. And no discussion, no check, no polling of votes. The whole thing's a fraud. Well, we all know it's a fraud. Now, the question is, what is the destiny of that fraud? I would say that what is happening to Obama now, what's happening internationally with the rapid collapse of the whole system, is going to blow this thing wide open. How it's going to blow it open, as I indicated earlier, as you know, in these cases, you cannot exactly predict it's going to work this way or that way, because people will turn this way or that way, and you'll get different processes, and the enemy will react in different ways. So, but from a standpoint of policy, for us, the policy is, well, this is not decided, this is a fraud, it's fake anyway, there's no proof of the vote. We know people were threatened if they denied that they'd voted that way, on top of it. So, well, what's going to do? Well, we just come to the point that the reckoning will come. When it will come is what we don't know. But the potential reckoning is there. I see an explosion, as I indicated today in this discussion. I see we're on the edge of an explosion which cannot be controlled, because everything is coming apart. It is becoming apparent. The system is breaking down. It's apparent that those in power either don't know what to do or don't have the guts to do it. And therefore, there's going to be an explosion from the population, because the suffering of the population with a collapse of any access to money, what we're talking about, this is riot time. You're on the edge of it, because you cannot oppress our people this way and not finally reach a point at which everything blows up. And we're on the edge. So I think to avoid a negative explosion, it's necessary to try to engineer a positive one. And that is to simply take what's happening. People out there in all kinds of groups are reacting to this Obama phenomenon as a fraud. And they are affirming their right to intervene in this situation on both issues as such, on political issues, and on the question of a fraud. That means that we don't have a danger of an explosion, because you have a rational process of people who are mobilizing to get to the point where they can take over. The danger point comes when you don't have the mobilization to take over, but you have only an explosion from below. That's the danger. And therefore, the motion by these people who are mobilizing around this to get this out and coming together more and more, and the failure of Obama, the crisis, this is all creating the potential for leadership. And if we don't get leadership, we're going to get chaos. So we have to work on the leadership.
You know, as always, we have far more questions than I'm going to have time to entertain. I will actually pose two more questions to Lynn before we close. But before I do that, I usually save this for the end of these presentations, but it would really be irresponsible of me not to raise this question now, because the number of questions, and in some cases not questions, but just comments that are coming in from people around the United States, on the one hand thanking us for producing the 1932 feature, thanking us for the Soros pamphlet, but complaining that we're not getting it out broadly enough, or complaining that we are, why did it take us so long? And how, you know, why don't we understand that it's going to take millions of these pamphlets to really shape the thinking of the population? Well, let me just say this to all of you. We understand a little bit more about organizing than you do. And we understand very well how many pamphlets it is necessary to get into circulation. We also understood the need for the 1932 feature long before it actually came out. The problem is not that we don't understand. The problem is that we lack funds. And I say this not, please understand, I'm not saying this with any hostility toward the people who posed the question. What I'm saying is what you have to understand is that we need money. And that what Mr. LaRouche represents, as I think was shown once again today, is a unique understanding, a unique quality of leadership, a unique ability and willingness to intervene into this crisis. And the only thing that stops us from doing it more quickly and more broadly is that we lack the funds to do it. So if you would like to see us do more of it, if you would like to see things like the 1932 feature get out more quickly, if you are distressed that we have not yet mailed that DVD and that pamphlet to every delegate to the Democratic Convention, and I assume you are distressed because I am distressed, don't send me an email complaining about it. Do something about it. Send me a check. And since you do so well navigating around the site, I'm sure you can find the address. The next question is from John Jeffries, who is a machinist from Louisville, Kentucky. He's also a Democratic Party activist. He says, Lynn, as you're aware, we're engaged in a very nasty fight here in Louisville to get the HBPA passed by our city council. The fight doesn't only pertain to our jurisdiction. This is going on all over the country and obviously very much in the U.S. Congress. This city, as all major formerly industrial cities, is deteriorating, and it is deteriorating fast. We are losing industries, jobs, and homeowners are being foreclosed upon at record rates. The HBPA, as you well know, has been endorsed by most of the labor movement in this state. It has passed the state Senate and numerous other bodies. And ridiculously, it is stuck in the Louisville City Council. The president of the council, one Jim King, has temporarily stymied us. He owns a bank. He's the former state chair of the Kentucky Bankers Association. And he's also very ambitious. He and another guy who has been in touch with our congressman gave the word to stop the resolution. I don't think that all politicians are corrupt or ignorant, despite a certain amount of empirical evidence in that direction. What I want to ask you is, what do you think is really behind the denial of these guys on the dire shape of our economy? Why would a banker be dead set against a resolution that doesn't just protect the homeowner, but protects him as well? He is really stirring the flames of antagonism, and we are going to pay the price for it as a nation. They have stupidly pitted the banks against the people when, in fact, we have proposals that could easily save both. What is your take on this stupidity?
Something like this. You're not getting usually a normal reaction, particularly when they're persistent and when it comes from someone who is in some kind of significant political position. It means it's an operation from within the Democratic Party in particular, from the dirty side, which is the Soros, etc. side. We're a threat to these characters. And they do what they can. You have to look at the other side in order to define your approach. look at where the cases where they have failed to produce that effect. Look at the limited number of cases of that type. We take the case of Kondrosky in Pennsylvania. What's happened with him recently is reality cuts in. And now what's happening this week is going to change things. Because the bottom is going out. This Wachovia thing is going to hit. It's going to hit like wildfire. It's going to have other ramifications. It's going to pull other things down. Wachovia going down has going to have a crossfire effect. You're going to have little hand grenades going off in various people's hip pockets. Because when Wachovia's collapse is a link in a chain. The link blows, the chain flies loose. So this is a Wachovia thing. Unless something remarkable is done to contain it, it's going to blow this situation wide open. And it's what you have to do in this case is knowing this is the situation. When you've got that, you get the bomb in the corner. I say, hey, have you had enough? You're going to give it up? And he says, no. Well, then who are you really working for? Why don't you come out in the open and say who you're really working for? And you spread that around, and you'll neutralize him. Not always, but that's the approach. It's what does work. You have to suck it out, but you have to think about winning. And therefore, sometimes you have to take it, something like it's happening now. This guy's got another chance coming up. But put it to him. Put it to him now. When the chain reaction effect of Wachovia and other things is going to hit. What's the matter with you? You stupid or something? Yeah? That's the way to do it. What's wrong with you? Is somebody bribing you? They got a gun up your rear end?
Again, for those of you who submitted questions that I didn't get to, I will give them to Lynn, and some of them will be answered. A lot of them, I think, have already been answered in the course of today's presentation. I'm going to close with a question from one of our youth supporters who is celebrating her 21st birthday tomorrow. And she says, Lynn, what do the youth of today who refuse to be associated with the mindless, MySpace-obsessed masses, those of us that are working full-time jobs and hardly able to eat, do to be able to say that we did not sit idly by and watch the world be destroyed? Where do we start, and how do we know our efforts will not be for naught? Many of us would rather die than vote for either candidate. Many more of my generation feel that because we don't know where to look for truth, that we have no business voting at all. And most of us feel that we will not be heard anyway. Do you have answers for us?
Well, I have a method of answering, I think. It's better than say answers. We've been working out nearby here and in other locations on the question of how to get ideas across to people. Especially, we have looked at generational strata in particular. Because remember that the past 7+ years, and worse actually, there's some longer, we have been under a dictatorship of not only brute force, but utter stupidity. Contemptible stupidity, the Bush administration. Two degenerations of the Bush administration. So this has an effect, along with the economic conditions, an effect upon the minds of young people between 18 and 25, as distinct from the generation which was then 18 to 25, 70 years ago. the generation which was that 18 to 25, 7 years ago, had different qualities then and now than the generation which is now between 18 and 25. That's not categorical, but it's general in the tendency. MySpace and Facebook typify that problem. You have something like mindless zombies coming out of the Black Lagoon. And that's what the phenomenon. What you have is a break from relevance. You have people, like the characteristic of MySpace and Facebook is what? You're not in the real universe. And this goes together with the killer games, which are less in the press nowadays, but they're still the same phenomenon out there. The killer computer games. People who are divorced from any connection with reality, who don't see the social process in which they are involved as a social process as having any meaning, and they act like goons or Black Lagoon types coming out of the swamps. And that's what happened with Obama, the Obama campaign. A lot of the campaign, as we saw in Texas in particular, were goon marches. You have people would assemble, and they would assemble, they're like loose nuts. And then when they would get together to demonstrate, they would go through a monotonous kind of chanting and then go off and break up. It really is like a slime mold, actually, formation. They had, in other words, individually, they had no intellectual character to speak of, or a very poor one. The only way they could have an intellectual character is by grouping together, like a slime mold in that phase, of the hot slime mold phase, and then they would suddenly march in a certain way and make a demonstration, then dissipate. No character, no individual character whatsoever. So you had a destruction of the population. Now you have also then with the generation now between 25, 26, and 35, which went through this thing before the BB, before Bush. They have also problems. It's differentiated. It's not homogenous. So we find that what you've got is a result of the educational process, the recent years and so forth. You find the ability to turn words or the use of words as such into some kind of meaningful expression of ideas is extremely limited, even with the 18 to 35 generation. Oh, some people could do as well as others, but we're talking about the generation as a whole, as a generation. So therefore, we had to make a decision, and I made a decision which was sort of evolving. And we did some of them just started and did the 1923 video on the German experience of hyperinflation and what's behind that. And what I saw was that in what was done to produce the final version that was published of the 1923 video, that I saw that we had in the youth organization, we had a capability had been developed to do this kind of thing. And what you saw as the 1932 video and some other things are products of that. Now, what we use in this thing, what I've emphasized, is to use the principle of classical tragedy as actually used by Aeschylus in ancient Greece, or is used by Shakespeare, or is used by Schiller, or in a different way by Lessing. And to use the method of classical drama as a way of organizing ideas to present them to people so they would see them as ideas. Because what happens to generations that had been afflicted by this kind of cultural degeneration can't put ideas together. This is helped by the music culture, the music deculture. People make bang, bang, bang noises. There's no coherence. There's no meaning to it. It's garbage. But they're used to garbage. You know, it's like they get hungry, they get fed on garbage, and they become conditioned, and they insist on eating nothing but garbage. This also happens in musical appetites, the same way as it does in other ways. So what we found is that by using, and you saw this with the effect of the circulation of the 1932 video in the political process. It worked. My view is that classical tragedy and similar kinds of drama, as understood by so-called educated opinion for some time, is a danger to your mental health. Because the problem is that in society, there are no individual tragic figures. There are individuals in tragedy, but they're not individual tragic figures. As the case of Hamlet, for example, illustrates, or any other great classical drama illustrates. The problem in society, as in classical drama, as when you understood, for example, Aeschylus, or even going back to the Iliad, where you have these gods up there who are manipulating these people, these real so-called real-life flesh-and-blood people, the mortals. And the immortals are up there, and they're plotting and scheming. I'm going to play with this one. I'm going to do this with this one. I'm going to do this with that one. Right? And you realize that what has happened with the Iliad, with the Homeric Iliad, as with other classical Greek drama, and then in the modern times, is the use of the gods. And the use of these gods in the classic was a way of getting to people the way in which the dynamic works in classical tragic drama. The tragedy lies in the gods. Now, are the gods real? In a sense, yes, but also not. But the gods are what are manufactured as the objects of worship or fear by a group of people. The way the people react as individuals to each other, as in, say, for example, the Iliad. How do they act to each other? On the basis of individual decision to individual decision? No. On what god they're attached to. What god they think has orchestrated the scenario. So true tragedy is never the tragic individual. True tragedy is society controlled by an idea which dominates a group of people. For example, as I often reference this funny little thing in the Julius Caesar of Shakespeare, Casca, asked about Cicero. It was Greek to me. Because the Cicero is the figure in that time with a real life historical Cicero, in which he represented the last bastion of reason against what Rome, future imperial Rome, had become, the Caesarian Rome had become. And therefore, the characters in this drama, which correspond highly by Shakespeare's creation, correspond highly to the actual situation in the Caesarian phenomenon, in the Roman history. The people are controlled by something they don't understand, which they recognize and they respond to. Just like the gods of the Iliad are controlling the drama of the Iliad. Or in Shakespeare, the same thing. So the incompetent director, an incompetent actor, will always try to get a scenario. Oh, this guy is the bad guy, this guy's the good guy, this is the hero, this is the tragic figure. Nonsense. What it is, it's always, as in our society, the tragic principle lies in the culture, in the people of the culture. And what we have to get at is making clear to people not only the tragic character of the culture which has gripped us in this present crisis of the United States and the world, but to understand how to break that culture. How to free people from the grip of a tragic culture. And that's what we found, which you can see with this, with 1932, on the Franklin Roosevelt thing, for many people who came in contact with that, for them, it broke the tragic bond. And therefore, what we're doing in answer to the question specifically is by relying upon what we recognize is the issue and saying, get your dumb actors out of here, get your dumb directors, get your critics out of here. We know what the tragic principle is. And we know it since the Iliad, and even earlier. But we know it since the Iliad in detail. Just read the Iliad. It's there. It's all there. The whole story's there. The secret's there. Then go to Aeschylus, or take Seven Against Thebes. It's another case of that kind of thing. Just go through that. It's there. This is what's wrong with us. This is Hamlet. Hamlet is not a tragic figure. Hamlet's a piece of garbage in a garbage culture. And it's the garbage culture that controls him. He goes through the thing, he's going to make, the ghost, my father's ghost. And sneaky, cowardly, the play's the thing to catch the conscience of the king. Next time you see him, I give it all up. It's gone. Get the hell, sweet. I'm going to kill myself. And then you have at the end of the thing with Shakespeare, as Horatio's there, they're all, Hamlet's corpse is being carried off stage. They're preparing for a new war under Norwegian leadership. And Horatio's saying, somebody stop this thing. Let's go review this thing and see what really happened here. And that is the approach we have to take in mass education, in political education, to get across to people. We have to finally go back to classical drama as to inform us as to how to reach the population in general of today. And we saw with the FDR case, it works. So let's do it.
Lynn has done what no one heretofore has succeeded in doing. She's left me speechless. What can I say? Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Lynn for today's presentation. I'm not so speechless that I forgot that thing I said about sending money.